Let's welcome everybody for the Word of the Buddha class. Just let everyone get settled and get my tablet going. And for those of you who haven't been here before, this is using a volume which was first published in English in 1906. It's very ancient, but it's authentic teachings of the Buddha as best we can know them from the suttas. But instead of using the old translations, and anyone of you who have gone through those translations in the suttas, you can see that sometimes they are very thick with repetitions which take away the flow of what's being described. It's also, the translations are usually word for word, whereas anyone knows that the unit of language is a sentence, not a word. So here I've been translating them sentence by sentence, and the word only has a meaning in its context, so not word for word, but sentence by sentence. And that also allows you to actually get some more interesting renderings for key Buddhist words. So it's not what you've heard before, but you can recognize it, and it seems to be much more powerful. So, you know, you're clearing away a lot of the rust from the Buddha's teachings, so you can actually see it shining. It's also, because it's much clearer, you also find that it's much more challenging. Some of the things which it says there are just, wow, this is quite something different than you may have heard before. So that's why it should not be just telling you what you've heard before, but actually seeing deeper in to what the Buddha actually taught. And again, it's not ever going to be the final version, because language always changes, evolves. We always find a better description of what the Buddha was actually saying, and so that this is always going to be work in action. But anyway, last time I was presenting this class, we presented, starting off with, it's the Four Noble Truths. Part of the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path. So we're now on to that seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is called the Satipatthana. And that Satipatthana, here we go, mindfulness of the citta, the mind. Now, each one of these always starts off with how do you do this right mindfulness. I'm going to go back to page, I've got 37, the very start of right mindfulness. So before I do that, I should always do the respects of Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. So we do the Arahang Sama. We did Namotassa, sorry. Do Arahang as well. Yeah, okay. Nice. Just do Namo Tassa, sorry. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. So, if you go to the very start of the right mindfulness, I've got on page 37, just the summary, the four focuses of mindfulness. They lead in one direction only. It never ever means just the only path. That cannot be sustained through reason. To the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana, what are the four? And in each one of these, I'm just going to go down to number three now, because this is the introduction to the mindfulness of the mind. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the mind, energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. Always having restrained the five hindrances, being the first, before you have enough mental power to be able to do a Satipatthana practice. So now that is implied with each one of these satipatthanas. Now I go back to the satipatthana of the mind. Here we go, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of the citta. How are you mindful of the mind? Okay, so it says, you got that now? Okay. Is that, I got on my page 41. Is that what you got? Okay, it doesn't matter, because sometimes different versions. 48, okay. Mindfulness of the citta, the mind. Third of the satipatthanas. Mindfulness of the mind. Third satipatthana. Pretty simple to find. How are you mindful of the mind? You understand a mind that is affected by wanting. You got it? Okay, good. Now, straight away, you understand. It says not you're mindful of a mind that's affected by wanting. The word is understand, pajanati. It is the verb which most people might know. That's a verb. The noun form is called panya, wisdom. So this is just how you get wisdom. You understand a mind, a citta, that is affected by wanting as such, and a mind that is unaffected by wanting as such. You understand a mind that is affected by aversion as such, and a mind that is unaffected by aversion as such. You understand a mind that is affected by the delusion as such, and a mind that is unaffected by delusion as such. And that wanting, that aversion, and that delusion, of course, those are what's called the three kilesas, the three poisons, whatever you wish to call it. Very often the word was greed, hatred, and delusion. Or even sometimes people say greed, hatred, and ignorance. None of those translations was really adequate. It's much more subtle than greed. It is wanting, which is a much more powerful word, a much more all-embracing, covers many more things. It's not just being greedy, it's wanting even good things, let alone bad things. And the aversion is not just ill will, hating your boss. It's just really don't want to be here. It's a much more subtle form of negativity. And of course, it's not just ignorance, because many people know what they should be doing, but why can't they do it? It's much deeper than that. It's delusions. So this is why I prefer the translations of wanting, aversion, and delusion. And so that's the first one. Do you understand a mind which is affected by these things? Sometimes you have what's called in part of the historical present. In other words, you understand right now that my mind was deluded, that my mind was averse, that my mind did have wanting. In other words, when the wanting or the delusion is really great, of course you don't understand it properly at all, which is one of the reasons why it is important that we also understand what we call the historical present in Pali, which is you understand a mind, it's either affected now or it just was. And also you understand a contracted mind that is contracted because of dullness and drowsiness. That is the third hindrance. Sometimes you call it sloth and torpor. But again, those are not usually words which people use in everyday discourse. How many times do you say, I feel slothful this morning? I feel torpid. You say, I feel dull. Yeah, you know what that is. Drowsy, you know what that is. So this is important when you make translations, to make sure that it's actually words which mean something to people. So just because, you know, we heard it before, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, whatever, you know, just because you've heard it before, we can do better. So by dullness and drowsiness, and it is worthwhile noting, the Buddha calls that a contracted mind. Why do you call it like contracted? You know, because when you are dull, your mind is just very, very narrow. It's like in a prison. It's just really small. And it's a very good metaphor You know, to have that width, to have that freedom, you know, is you overcome that dullness. You can only see tiny bits. That's also with light depression as well. It's a contracted mind. And it's the Buddha's simile here, but it actually opens up when we just stop a little while on that description. Sloth and torpor, contracted. Just know what it actually means, what it feels like. It gets more of an understanding of what that state is and just how it stops you with the width, with the freedom to really explore and understand the true Dhamma. And you also understand a distracted mind is distracted because of restlessness and remorse. The remorse business is called kukkha. It is especially when you've done something you think might be wrong. You know, you kicked the dog this morning, you shouted at somebody or whatever. And, you know, sometimes we have that feeling of almost guilt, being remorseful. That is a negative in Buddhism. Whereas, and I mentioned this quite a few times, and it actually was taken on board whenever I go to UWA to give a lecture on law and religion and just some of the things which the legal profession should take into account when dealing with, say, Buddhists, that, you know, sometimes a Buddhist will not feel remorseful from their acts. And that, for many sort of judges, would be a negative. That would be shown you're callous, you're uncaring, and you get your sentence increased, your punishment added to, simply because that we accept that remorse is part of human nature and that the lack of remorse means a lack of morality. But here we look at sort of restlessness and remorse as actually something, especially remorse, which is a negative. It means a distracted mind. Instead of just letting it go, learning from it and moving on, we're always distracted by some of the bad deeds of our past. And it's also the restlessness as well, which again is always a distracted mind. And I'm going off subject here, but you know, where does restlessness come from? Why can't you sit still? It's because your chair is not comfortable. Why is the mind always thinking, fantasizing, planning, remembering? Why do people always seek for drama in life? Let's mention this. Sometimes everything's going nice and peaceful in the monastery, and then something goes, what are you that for? And you think, oh, it's because sometimes people don't like peace. They want some drama, something to do, something to worry about, something to, you know, get upset about. Anyway, that's the cause of restlessness. We're afraid of contentment. But anyway, so we've got the restlessness, and that's a distracted mind, literally all over the place. So contracted and distracted too far away. Now, you understand that mind, or you also understand they have quite a few Pali words, but they are also always explained as exactly the same. You understand an exalted mind, a surpassed mind, a still mind, and a liberated mind, and they're all referring to the achievements or experiences of jhanas. As such, and one which is unexalted, unsurpassed, not still, not liberated, as not in jhana as such. So first of all, you understand the greed, hatred, delusion, the dullness and restlessness, and you can make a connection there between the five hindrances. The wanting, first hindrance, aversion, second hindrance, delusion, fifth hindrance, doubt, and the third and fourth hindrance, the distracted mind and the contracted mind, you know, the dullness and drowsiness and restlessness and remorse. And the opposite of those five hindrances, jhana minds. So it's basically, to keep it very simple to understand this, and you can see that this makes a lot of sense here. You've got the five hindrances, enemies, if you like. When those five hindrances are understood, overcome, then the jhanas happen. It's not what you want, it's just nature. And in this way, you're aware of your own citta, this thing which is called a mind. They don't actually say what the mind is here in the state, but you understand just it's either a beautiful mind or a defiled mind. So you know it by those two characteristics. This is also, for those of you who have heard me, the second of the Satipatthanas, Vedana. You know that you hear me call it like experience, instead of what many people say is feeling. They say, well, it's the nice feeling, pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or in between. But that is not what we're really focusing on. That just describes what experience are, the three types of experience. Just so we know we're focusing on what experience is. So Vedana means experience, not the happy or the sad or the in-between part of it. Same here, we're focusing on the mind over here. Not defiled or released. The mind. It's the mind which can manifest in those basically two states. Jhanic or defiled. So it's ways of understanding what this mind actually is. Yeah. Ooh.
So just to make sure I understand, when you say the citta, is this the summation of all the four khandhas or just the consciousness itself?
What actually is the citta? And the really only way we can know this is that when all the other of the sense bases, the five sense bases, vanish. I'm going, this is not here, but it's in another sutta, the simile of the goldsmith. That if you have a goldsmith, to understand the nature of gold, its properties, to understand what is gold, you have to purify it of all other impurities. You could have some tin or some lead in it, so you get pure 100% gold. And then you can do your experiments, know exactly what gold is. And there was a simile to be able to understand what this mind is, a citta, to make sure it's released, purified from the other five senses. So, what actually is it? That is how you find out, you experience it, to get directions, get some intellectual understanding what it is. The way that the Buddha used this word, citta, is there's a couple of places. One is in the very famous, the eighth of the wrong views in the Digha Nikaya, Brahmajala Sutta. He said, that which we call citta or vijnana, consciousness, or mano, which is specifically the sixth sense base. He said, what people call that, that's, you know, not permanent, not me, not mine, doesn't sort of persist. The point being here is the Buddha was acknowledging that people do not use these terms like philosophers or lawyers. They're terms used in ordinary life, the mind, the consciousness, the heart, whatever you wish to call it. So we have an idea of the body with the mind. But what actually is it? So to be able to be aware of the citta, to be able to even to do that satipatthana, the third satipatthana, really you actually have to have some idea of what to look at. To know the whole breadth of the mind, but at least you can have some idea of the mind. And surprise, surprise, though you know you've been coming off to my meditation classes long enough now, you know that after being aware, relaxing your body, then I ask people to go and have a look at their piezometer. Where the heck did that come from? What is the piezometer anyway? You're doing the third satipatthana here. You're being aware of the mind, whether it's contracted or distracted, peaceful. So yeah, you're getting a first little glimpse of what we mean by being aware of a mind. that particular quality. You don't know exactly what the mind is, but you know peace, you know agitation, distracted, sleepy, you can know that much. And so you're being aware of the mind by its qualities. You understand what a garden is by flowers and weeds. You see flowers, you see weeds, that's the garden somewhere. Get some idea there? Very good. Because the jitta is quite fundamental, it's really strong, it's important, that's why people get some really weird ideas what the jitta is. But anyway, this is where you start to learn about it. And in this way, you're aware of your own jitta, you get to understand it. You're aware of the other's jittas are the same nature as yours. That when they handed out jitters, you didn't get a bad deal. And it's not as if there's like sometimes you get, well, what was it, the Samsung 9 and the battery kept on exploding and had a recall. So, is it Samsung 8 or 9 or so? 8, was it?
7.
7, okay, I don't know. Anyway, you get the message here, sometimes there's a recall because it's a defective product. And we always sometimes think, my jitter is defective. Other people's jitter is okay. And it's no. So what it says here is, you're aware of your own jitter, you're aware other jitters are of the same nature as yours. So don't try and hand it back and get a refund. Or, you're aware both your own and other's jitters. You know, the jitters are jitters, that's all. Or, now most importantly here, you abide aware of what causes the arising of the citta, the appearance of it. And that is nama rupa. And we're not going into the Abhidharma description of nama rupa, which really messed up the whole thing by giving a different description as in the suttas. Nama rupa is basically the object of the consciousnesses. They have this beautiful simile of the sheaves of reeds, like the people drying hay. Or if you've ever been to Asia, you see after the reaping the rice harvest and threshing the rice to get the little buds off, which is the rice, and then you dry the straw, which is a really important product. To be able to dry, you have to lean it up against one another in order for the air to get in for them to dry. That was a common practice in those days. And you take one of those sheaves of straw or reeds away, the other one falls down. That was the Buddha's simile. They support one another. And so this is like nama rupa, the objects of consciousness of the citta and the citta itself. And here again, for those of you who know your Pali or know these suttas, citta is caused by nama rupa, but also you have in dependent origination, vijnana and nama rupa support one another. So even the vijnana in dependent origination, citta here, sometimes those words are used almost interchangeably. And when people try and find a difference between the two of them, said, oh, vijnana, that's part of the khandhas. Citta is outside of the khandhas. That doesn't make any sense. That's going much further than is makes sense. So what we do here is citta to cittas, and what causes citta is nama rupa. Are you quite aware that the citta is the nature to cease? To cease means to stop, vanish, disappear, gone. Really? When nama rupa ceases, when the objects of consciousness cease, then citta ceases. Or you buy contemplative citta's cause of nature, both arising and ceasing. Arising and ceasing doesn't mean like waves on the surface of a lake where there's always a lake there. This means these things arise and then they cease. The citta doesn't play around some underlying piece of existence which is always there, and sometimes it manifests into a jitta. No, it ceases. When one thing disappears, the other one ceases. Gone. Vanished. Whereas mindfulness is just jitta, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence. Just jitta, that's all. Not me. You don't identify with the jitta. You don't own the jitta. It's not a permanent essence. It's not a fundamental identity which lasts forever. No way. That was particularly wrong view number 8 in the what's it called? Brahmacharya Sutta, first of the Digha Nikaya. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. You let go of the jitta. Rather, the jitta just disengages from itself. Da da da. That is how you're mindful of the mind. Any questions on that? Yes.
Ajahn, are these experiential knowledges?
Experiential knowledges. First of all, you hear the teachings, discuss them, think them over, just get understand them, asking the questions like you're doing, until you get familiar with the map. But that's all it really is. It's a map, but you understand the map, and then you travel there. And to check it out. It doesn't matter how well you know a map. In Google Maps, even you can see street views, I don't know, whatever you can see, but actually being there is very different. So being there, you need the map, but you need the experience, you need the two together. But here, you are aware of these things, you've got to experience what a dull mind, what a jhana mind is. Otherwise, you haven't completed the Satipatthana here. And then you understand how these things arise and how they pass away. What causes the arising of these things? What causes the arising of a jitta even in jhana? It's not willpower. Right objects come up.
So Ajahn, the map and the experience, is that dependent on how powerful the mindfulness is? Like if it's weak, you might have the intellectual...
How mind. Powerful the mindfulness is. It is, there's many, many things which create sort of the power to be able to practice these Satipatthanas. Remember the beginning, there's a reason why I said at the very beginning that, that you have... restrained the five hindrances. Vinaya, Loke, Abhijja, Dommanasa. The Vinaya doesn't mean totally abandoned, because that comes after the jhanas. To totally abandon the five hindrances, you've weakened them. Really restrained them. To the very, not very. And how do you do that? By the first six factors of the Eightfold Path you've been practicing before. You've got a right view, you understand. This is not an achievement, not a personal gain. At least you have that idea. So you're not trying, you're letting go, renouncing. You have the second factor, which I focus on, renouncing, being kind, being gentle. Sometimes I call it make peace, being kind, being gentle. The right motivation, where you're coming from. The kindness, the gentleness, the letting go. That's the second factor. And from then, the kindness, renunciation, the gentleness, you get all of your precepts from there. The right speech, action, livelihood. Where does that come from? It comes from the other factors. And you have right speech, action, livelihood. You don't have so much remorse, hardly any remorse. You're peaceful, you've got joy, you've got inspiration. If you keep precepts and morality, you get this huge boost of mindfulness energy. That's in the Samanyapada. It's the joy. Avayapaja Sukha, when you have the beautiful virtues, the blameless happiness, and then through the restraint, furthering the restraint, the right effort, endeavor, is in saying no. That renunciation, which does take a little bit of commitment, endeavor. That's a good word, right? Commitment. Yeah. I like that one. Okay. So from that image you get much more power, and from that you get the energy. Okay. Oh, John was first, sorry. John at the front.
The imaginary self, does the mind create that?
Oh, yeah.
Or is it separate from the mind, the imaginary self?
Oh, imagine the mind. Well, what the mind is. The mind right now creates an imaginary self for the next moment, and that becomes a mind. Basically, imaginary self, what actually do you mean by that? It is this mind, together with delusion, together with many other sort of qualities, this actually creates. From the delusion, we have this sankhara, this will. And as the will creates, more delusion. Perpetuates. Imaginary self creates whatever suffering. One of the most interesting and illuminating teachings of the Buddha was, you know, the Vipalasas. You know, view, if you have, you know, a wrong view, not accurate view, it means you create inaccurate perceptions. And inaccurate perceptions, that's where we build up our thoughts, our philosophies. I've felt this, I've seen it, it has to be true. Can we believe our perceptions too much? And then from those perceptions, we get our view, our thoughts, views, and the views go back and just pervert our perceptions. This is the old vicious cycle. You can start anywhere you like on that three things. The distortion of the cognitive process. Say you have a wrong thought, that gives, you know, that, well, it's, that's what builds up your views. From wrong thoughts you get defective views. From defective views you get defective perceptions. Defective perceptions, more defected thoughts. You can see that happening. Look, an obvious example is that President Donald Trump, you know, he actually believes what he says. It's a weird thing when somebody is obviously just, you know, it's not sort of seeing things like people should see them. You start anywhere, view that he's, what is it, a stable genius. I remember read the other day. If you have that view, then it's obvious, that's how you perceive yourself. As you perceive, so you think. And your think just reinforces your views. That's why that whole cognitive process, even trusting bare perceptions, is very dodgy. So, how do we overcome that? What perverts that process which actually stops you seeing truth, perceiving properly, is five hindrances. You see what you want to see. You believe what you want to believe. When those wants and those aversions, sloth and torpor, the dullness which contracts the mind, no restlessness and remorse, you're not distracted. You're precise. And you're courageous. You don't see what you expect to see, what you want to see. You see what's there.
Quite on occasions you say things like, we should be kind to our minds. It sounds as though that we, the self, imaginary self, is separate from the mind. We're going to be kind to it.
So that thing, that's just the they call it conventional speech. You have to, if you try and do it another way around, say the five khandhas should be kind to the five khandhas. And so, but we use ordinary speech. But it is just the skillful means that I am, in a very nice way, telling you to be kind to your mind, conditioning you, brainwashing you, asking you, suggesting to you, putting in sort of that that little seed which you cannot come from your own cognitive process. This is totally off subject, but I always used to think that, oh, this idea of transmission only comes in Vajrayana Buddhism. There's no. You can actually see just where, you know, the seeds of wisdom actually come from. know, to have the words of somebody else who knows what they're talking about is an important part for you to see. So I'm shameless, honest, upfront. I do sort of brainwash you, John. And so when I say we should do this, you know, you have some trust in me. So I'm putting that suggestion in your head. And you may think that, you know, you're doing it. It's not your imaginary self. It's my imaginary self creating that. Do you understand that? Interesting part. Okay, yeah?
I may have misheard. Did you say a chitta can arise during jhana?
Chitta arises during the jhanas. Of course, arises during the jhanas, yes, as one exits a jhana, or as one goes from one jhana to another jhana, as the things change, yes, that is a possibility. But it's not really what I said. What I said is that from nama rupa, from objects of consciousness, then you get the consciousness or jitta. You need something to be aware of. That is one of the ways that the jhanas actually work. So you're really, really still, just almost like a single object of perception, especially from the second jhana onwards. Single object, because nothing moves, nama rupa does not support the continuation of that chitta. It turns off and something deeper comes, and then something deeper. It's from stillness things vanish. So that's actually the process. And that's why how the immaterial, the arupas happen. Incredibly still. You can't get more still than the fourth jhana. But if there's something still, nama rupa, nothing's happening, things turn off. It's not what you do, it's just what happens. From stillness, things start to vanish. Until everything's gone.
Thanks, Ajahn.
Okay. The amazing chitta. Okay. Oh, you got one, yeah?
Ajahn, how can one abide with the mind of aware of other someone else's mind? Like you have to have a sixth sense or something?
Oh, no. It's, remember, it's that you're not aware, you pajanati. It's great when you actually point this out. So how you imagine that you understand a mind that is affected by wanting. In this way, you are aware of your own jitta, you're aware that other jitta is the same as yours, you abide aware of both your own and other's jittas because you understand these jittas are of the same nature. So, it's the understanding. Once you have that understanding, then the awareness, the mindfulness is always used in the case that you see things as they truly are. Keep in mind that you know that other people's jittas are the same as yours. Same nature. Okay, just one question next. I should be going off, carrying on, if that's okay. Just one question per person. Oh, no, you've already done yours. Yeah, so wait till the next pause and then you can ask another question. Okay, so we'll go off to the mindfulness of the jitta, now the mindfulness of the mind objects. That's all there is for the mindfulness of the mind. Very short. How are you mindful of the mind objects? And again, that first introduction, which is having restrained the five hindrances, energized, understanding the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. The purpose of what you're doing is an important part of it. That's called sampajanya. Why are we doing this? And it's not just to get enough material to get a PhD in neuroscience. It is, and it says here, you abide, in other words, the mindfulness is just a jitta, impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not self, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom is central to liberation. That is the purpose. So first of all, we have to have restrained the five hindrances, have enough mindful, and always keep in mind the purpose of this. What are they doing this for? So the five hindrances. You are mindful of mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. The mind objects, not the jitta now, what the objects of the mind is. So, when there was wanting regarding the five senses, you are mindful that there was such wanting. When there is no wanting regarding the five senses, you are mindful that there is no such wanting. You also understand how such wanting arises, how to let go of such wanting, and how such wanting doesn't arise again. This is the karma chanda, which is the wanting in the realm of the five senses. It does not affect actually the wanting in the realm of the mind. There being aversion in you, there being dullness and drowsiness in you, there being restlessness and remorse in you. When there was doubt in you, you are mindful there was such doubt. When there is no such doubt, you are mindful there is no doubt. You also understand how such doubt arises and how to let go of doubt, how doubt doesn't arise again. So there's an understanding here. You understand it. You understand when it's absent. And then you understand the cause, what makes, allows these things to arise, and how, you know, that these things don't arise in the future. So it is not just being aware, but it's for the purpose of understanding how these things work. So just like sometimes if any of you learn how to fix up your own cars, in the old days you could probably do that, I don't know, maybe it's just far too complicated these days, or fix up your own motorbikes, or fix up your own bicycles, that, you know, you mess around with it first of all, and you put it together again, just a bit of trial and error, you find out, you actually understand how these things work. What causes it to go well? What causes it not to go well? So this is where you understand these five hindrances. What causes them? What overcomes the dullness and drowsiness in you? And we go on to the little tangent on from Majjhima 39 about the five hindrances. Suppose you took out a loan and your business was successful. Then you repaid that loan, there was enough left over for your own enjoyment, for that of your family. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. Or suppose you were very ill. That was a simile for the first hindrance. So, first hindrance of like wanting things. It is a... whenever you have that wanting, that is some suffering there. You're actually in debt. And so, when you either get what you want, or you let go of wanting anything, when there is no wanting, then as if you have happiness. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So that's why taking a loan out, borrowing stuff. Or for the aversion, suppose you were very ill, you couldn't eat or sleep and had no strength. Later, however, you recovered. You can eat and sleep well again, and you regained your strength. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. The idea of aversion being like a sickness. When you're really ill will, you can't, you know, eat well, you can't sleep well. It was just what the Buddha used to say of like an anthill just burning during the day, smoking at night. So because of the ill will. Suppose you were imprisoned or later were released, safe and secure, with no loss to your property. As a result, you'll be glad and full of joy. That's the sloth and torpor, the constricted mind. Or suppose you're a slave, dependent upon others, and able to go where you want, and later you were released from slavery, independent of others, able to go where you want, as a result you'll be glad and full of joy. Restlessness and remorse. Remorse doesn't leave you alone. Even the restlessness is like a slave. You just can't be free and be here. You're always being told where to go, what to do. You can't sit down. Come and get up. Go and go down. Come and go here. Come and go there. It's like having a person in control of you all the time, which is called Mr. Will. Or suppose you had to travel along a dangerous road across a wilderness, but later you would pass through that wilderness safe and secure with no loss to your property. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. And that is the doubt, not really knowing which way you're supposed to go. So too, when these five hindrances were present, you look back upon them as a debt, wanting, a disease, aversion, a prison, dullness and drowsiness, slavery, restlessness and remorse, and a dangerous road across the wilderness, doubt. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned, you regard that as freedom from debt, health, release from a prison, freedom from slavery, and reaching a land of safety. Sometimes, every now and again you see articles on trying to abolish slavery in our world. I'm very much into abolishing slavery. being a slave to the wants of your mind, restless, never feeling free, always having to do something, go somewhere, a slave to your will. Anyway, the opposite of the five hindrances, the seven enlightenment factors. Or you are mindful of mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present, the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand that it is present. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness was not present, some translations, I've looked at them, when the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is not present in you, you understand that it's not present. If it's not present, you don't know what's going on. So what it means is historic present, the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you. Yeah, I know I'm mindful now, but if it was gone, I realized it was not there. You also understand how there comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of mindfulness and how it comes to fulfillment by development. It's not just by wanting that I become mindful. You understand what the causes of mindfulness are. What are the causes of mindfulness? First six factors of the Eightfold Path. How you develop it is through the strength of overcoming hindrances. And when the enlightenment factor of exploring the Dhamma is present in you, exploring the Dhamma, not thinking about the Dhamma. Because sometimes Dhamma vichaya, contemplating the Dhamma, and that gives some people who don't understand the meaning of those words license to go thinking about the most amazing Dhamma discourses, especially just, you know, when you're getting nice and peaceful. And you think, oh, I'm really clear now, I can really think about dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, the nature of existence. You think. That is not exploring the Dhamma. The old, you've seen me do this before, I'll do it very quickly. What is it I'm holding up now? And people say, it's a glass, it is actually not plastic, it is about 4 inches, it is conical, which is truncated cone. It is my 3/4 full of water. It is shiny, blah, blah, blah. That is not exploring the Dhamma. That is contemplating, thinking about it, which is gets you nowhere. But then you come to the point, you've exhausted all of your descriptions. So all those words which you were taught at school or other places, that's not what this is. Those are just the names, descriptions, old stuff. Until you can actually just allow your mind just to settle on this. Don't give it names. Don't try and get the right answer. It's interesting, as soon as I do this little experiment, people say glass. Say no. And then someone else, oh yeah, I got it. It's 3/4 full. Or whatever. 1/4 empty. They always want to get the right answer. Trying to get the right answer, that's just ego. Sense of self. It's not the right answer. Explore the Dhamma. Because the only thing you've got the right answer, you don't go any further. So, until you can see it and all the names disappear, then actually you can start really getting into it. Exploring the Dhamma, not what you've been taught. Never allow all your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. So, when the enlightenment factor of exploring Dhamma is in you, when the enlightenment factor of energy is present in you, and this is not coming from striving, you get the mindfulness, allow the mind to explore the Dhamma, you get really inspired, you get really high energy. And from your high energy, when the enlightenment factor of joy is present in you, joy, happy, be careful, you get attached to it, it never says that. Joy, if it comes from the right place, is good. It's what's supposed to happen. If it's present in you, understand it. Where it comes from and how it comes to fulfillment by development. You can fulfill the joy. The factor of tranquility. Tranquility, you don't again use willpower. Be still. Sit still. My headmaster used to say, sit still. That wasn't very pleasant at all. That's not how the factor of tranquility is present in you. It comes from the joy. If you're happy to be here, you've got a comfortable, happy seat, of course you don't need to move. And from joy, or from tranquility, the alignment factor of stillness is present in you. The still mind, samadhi, jhanas. And when the enlightenment factor of equanimity is present in you, you understand that it is present. When the enlightenment factor of equanimity was not present in you, you understand it was absent. You also understand how there comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of equanimity and how it comes from fulfillment by development. So those seven enlightenment factors of mindfulness, exploring Dharma, energy, joy, tranquility, stillness and equanimity, they are the direct opposites of the five hindrances. So five hindrances are the bad guys. Seven enlightenment factors are what happens when those hindrances are not just restrained, but just obliterated for a while. So that really, the causes of these things, that's why those two were the main part of the fourth Satipatthana. And before I go on to the other stuff, the great research done, many versions of this sutta is found in many places, and the earliest ones stopped there. The fourth Satipatthana, earliest versions only had five hindrances, seven enlightenment factors, nothing else. It's not that what comes later is wrong, but when you see that this was the earliest version of the Satipatthana Sutta, just five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors, it makes it powerful and far more clear. That's what we do these things for. Understand the purpose. When you're mindful, what causes them? Just like my old peaceometer, what causes the mind to be peaceful? What causes it to get agitated? Find out the causes, what makes it arise. Five hindrances. What causes the five hindrances? What causes the five hindrances to disappear? What causes the enlightenment factors? Things like exploring of the Dhamma, energy, joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity. What causes these? So that is our... And it's not you. It's not, you know, you're not skillful enough, not putting enough effort in. It's not wisdom, willpower. It's always wisdom power. So that's the main part of the fourth Satipatthana. Anyway, I'm going to go on to some the other parts of the Satipatthana, the last Satipatthana, the fourth Satipatthana, in a minute. But now I will pause for any questions again. Okay, yes. Yeah, Peter?
Just returning to previously, you said that everyone's chitta is the same. What about people with, say, for instance, autism? Or
that's just a brain thing. Underneath that, their mind is something which is behind that. The evidence behind that is just when, again, sometimes that when a person is about to pass away, and just whether they have dementia, whether they're in a coma, whether they have all sorts of other sort of cognitive impairments, but when that the last few moments of their life, very well known that people actually become really clear. If you're with an autistic person, interesting, just before they pass away, are they autistic? The last few moments of their life? Or is it just their brain has, you know, been impaired and just their chitta, their mind, just uses that brain, but it's just impaired. But once their brain stops, the chitta usually takes over for a few minutes. That's why there's so many people, comas, dementia, haven't known their sort of children for 3 or 4 years. Last minutes before they pass away. Hey John, where have you been all this time? Mom, I've been visiting you for the last 3 years. Have you? I remember the clarity in the last moment where the jitter takes over rather than the brain.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yes. Sue, over here. Sorry?
Terminal lucidity.
Oh, terminal lucidity is called. You even got a name for it.
So, Ajahn, we're working on purifying the mind so that in the end we can abandon it. And when we abandon it, it will cease to exist.
Yes, great, isn't it? Purify the mind. So why do we do that? Because of the sake of happiness. And it was a question which was asked, I think it was by Udayin of Sariputta. He said, what are we doing this for? He said, how can you say that Nibbana Paramang Sukhang, the cessation, is the highest happiness when there's nothing felt there? And that's when Sariputta gave this beautiful little simile that, you know, if you're sick and then the sickness vanishes, that's happiness. That happiness being defined as suffering disappearing. So in all the different parts, you know, we look after our body so that we can let it go. It disappears in the jhanas. It's hard actually to have, if your body is really, really sick, it's not impossible, but it's harder. Which is one of the reasons why before the Buddha became enlightened, he realized that jhanas was the way to Bodhi, that's what it says, to enlightenment, that's in the Mahasatika Sutta number 36 of the Majjhima Nikaya. Remembering, oh, this jhana, that must be the way to enlightenment. He realized, yes, it is the way to enlightenment. But then he thought, I'm so weak, it's too much asceticism, you know, I better sort of look after myself, get a bit more health. Because jhanas are hard to do with such an ascetic lifestyle. So, you look after your body so you can let it go, make it to disappear. You purify your mind so you can let go of your mind. Otherwise it's always bothering you. You purify things so they can disappear. Okay. So, here we go. Five hindrances, seven alignment factors. Now we also have in most versions of Satipatthana Sutta extras. You have five components of existence, six sense bases, four noble truths. An extra three here. There's nothing wrong with this, but it wasn't quite the earliest form of it. Or you are mindful of mind objects in terms of the five components of existence, such as form, its origin, its disappearance. Experience, the second, of form or body. Experience, such as origin, such as disappearance, such as perception, its origin, its disappearance, such as will, its origin and disappearance, such are consciousnesses, such the origin and a disappearance. And one of the most important little translations or retranslations is to call not consciousness but consciousnesses. There are six different types of consciousness. It's not just consciousness singular, because that starts people thinking of some soul or some essence. Six different types of consciousness. That's why I call consciousnesses. When one is there, the other ones aren't there. And such is the origin. Where the consciousness comes from? And it ceases. It disappears. It's not permanent. If it's not permanent, always there, it can't be your essential being. And perception. Its origin and disappearance. We trust in these things. It's my perception. I saw it for myself. It was real. And years and years ago, I remember so many years ago now, I was giving a talk in the Psychic Research Center or something. It was in Hay Street years ago, late at night. And on the way back, going down over the Causeway and Albany Highway, there was a car crash, which was right behind it. And we pulled up to assist. And then afterwards, because I saw it, The policeman asked me for the interview, what did I see? And then, afterwards, what I thought I saw actually wasn't, the colour of the car was wrong.
So it was a black car, and he said, no, look, it's over there, it's yellow. Oh, it's well known to policemen, because your memory, how you perceive things, you perceive actually what you thought happened, not actually what was true. You fill in the gaps. Perception is notoriously unreliable. There's no such thing as bare perceptions. But I saw it. Well, you had an experience, but you've interpreted it a long way since then. So anyway, that's experience, perception, will. Where does your will come from? What's the origin of the will? Is there some essential anusha inside who decides to smile? Or why did you smile? Had you any choice? Was it really? Where did your will come from? What's the origin of your will? Such is disappearance. What, you mean I'm taking away your will? I'm not taking it away, it just vanishes. Scary. That's what the Buddha says. It's origin disappearance. Or the six sense bases. Or you're mindful of mind objects in terms of six and external sense bases. You understand sight, understand forms, that's what sight sees. Understand the fetter that arises dependent upon both. Understand how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter. How comes the abandon of the arisen fetter? And how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. Wanting. You see things. As soon as you see things, you don't want to get rid of them. Or you want more of them. Amazing. Just sight is a big pain. And the pain in the eyeballs. Or whatever. And sometimes people just want to see more things. Have you seen the Great Wall of China yet? If you haven't, if you can't afford it, come to Bodhinyana, you can see the Great Wall of Bodhinyana. What do you want to see things for? Just conditioning people say, oh, you haven't lived until you've seen the, what? What's the latest thing you've got to go and see? I don't know. The Himalaya Mountains. Have you been to Mount Everest yet, the top of Mount Everest? I don't know, what do I go and see that for? Anyway, that's the fetter. That goes with all the other ones. You're mindful of mind objects in terms of hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and also the mind. Or in terms of the Four Noble Truths. You're mindful of mind objects in terms of the Four Noble Truths. You understand that it actually is, this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. Cessation of suffering, this is the way it leads to cessation of suffering. Now each one of those things, if you do them, then that's helpful because you understand the rising and passing away of these things, what causes them, and because they're caused, when the cause disappears, just like the old oil lamp simile, remember Akawacha Gota, the flame depends upon the wick, the heat and the oil. Is cause. When those three things come together, the oil, the wick, and the heat, you get the flame. But when one of those causes disappears, then the flame ceases in nirvana. That's what I mean by cause and effect. Just like the arising of will. Just like a flame. It has its causes. When you take one of those causes out, it disappears. It's not you. I mean, I'm not responsible for all my silly jokes. Yes. It's total conditioning. My father. Blame him all the time. Silly jokes he used to tell me. Anyway, the summary of the mind objects. In these ways you are aware of mind objects. Are you aware that others' mind objects are the same as yours? Same nature as yours, sorry. Are you like just the mindfulness is... If a Buddha is the same as the mindfulness in you, same nature. Maybe they're not as powerful, but the same nature. Or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of mind objects. Attention. We abide aware that when mind objects of the nature to cease, when the attention ceases, we abide at contemplating mind objects cause the nature of both arising and ceasing. Or else mindfulness is just mind objects impermanent suffering and not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential liberation. You abide independent, not clinging to anything in the whole world. That is how you are mindful of mind objects. And the summary. So, it was with reference to this that it was said the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only, to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, disappearance of physical and mental suffering, for the attainment of true way, for the realization of Nibbana. Now, any questions? We've got a little bit longer. Yes.
Going back to the question earlier on, the way I understood it, the brain and the mind.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've got a few friends at the moment who are suffering with Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's disease, quite a few people. And they've been getting very frustrated saying, the partner won't do what I tell them. They won't do it. They won't walk when they should be walking or whatever. And I say, well, the way I look at that is, it's not them being stubborn. It's like the wires are not connecting.
Exactly.
Would you think that's the correct way of probably
putting it over? Lovely description, yes. Because the wires are not connected properly and you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They're disconnected, so they don't follow your orders. Mm-hmm. It's in a sense, you could make it's frustrating, but it just shows you just how much you have to let go.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But it's wonderful if you do have the opportunity to be with them in the last moments of their life. Now they always say the terminal lucidity, and it's such an amazing thing that they've got no Alzheimer's. Where's the Parkinson's gone? Just because they're just about to go. The mind is free. Okay. So we'll go a little bit further through Nibbana through Anapanasati, if that's okay. Because sometimes, as many of you may have heard, that people think that Anapanasati is called Samatha and Satipatthana is called Vipassana. And just to make it quite sure that Nibbana through Anapanasati, I'll do more of this later on, the next time I'm here. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, Anapanasati, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. So you do Anapanasati, and then by doing Anapanasati, you do Satipatthana. The same. No different. Do Satipatthana by doing Anapanasati. So the idea that one is Samatha, the other one is Vipassana, is totally refuted. And this is the teaching of the Buddha. And when the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, enlightenment. So it's not a sort of separate practice. Anapanasati is Samatha and Vipassana, all rolled into one. And anyhow, this is from the Anapanasati Sutta. Mindfulness of breathing completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And it got some interesting little points here, which I'm going to bring out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, and you're aware that they are long, when the in-breath and out-breath are short and you're aware that they are short, when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm the body of the breath as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose of mindfulness and mindful, because in and out breathing is regarded by the Buddha as a body in the category bodies. It is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. And the point I'm going to just focus on this afternoon is that sometimes you get questions. It's a controversy which should never be controversial if people have a look at this passage from the word of the Buddha. The third of the stages of Anapanasati, of when you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out, the part is sabbakaya patisangvedi. You experience the whole of the kaya. And so some people say, okay, yeah, you know a long breath, you know a short breath, and now you go back to awareness of the whole body. You know, the toes, the arms, everything. And you know, to me that is just the hiatus in the meditation. You're trying to let go of the body, and now you have to go back to the body. What do you mean? You experience the whole body at this particular stage? And of course that's not what happens naturally. Naturally, once you start to know the breath, as the mindfulness increases, of course you get to know more of the breath. From the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath. The whole of this thing called an in-breath or an out-breath. So, but it says the whole body. And he said, look what the Buddha said. We call the in-breath and the out-breath a body in the category of bodies, says the Buddha. So it is by watching the breath at that stage, that counts as a body. It's said specifically by the Buddha here. And it's a natural progress. Even if you never learn Anapanasati, you just do it naturally. This is just what happens. As you calm and relax more and more, it's just not watching in, out, or long, or short, whatever. It's obvious that you get much more aware. You can see the very beginning of an in-breath, the very end of an in-breath. It's exactly the same as when you do your walking meditation, a changama. Yeah, you can start by, you know, noticing your lifting and walking, left step, right step. But after a while, you see just the whole of the many, many different movements, just in one step. You see the whole body of a step, of a left step, whole body of a right step. It's just not left, right, left, right, left, right. It's amazing just how things actually move through the air and how the foot meets the floor again afterwards. So I always quote this to confirm what happens quite naturally, and don't sort of misinterpret it or just spoil the natural progress of the meditation by asking the first two stages of Anapanasati, trying to become aware of your whole body. It doesn't mean that at all, it means the whole breath. And lastly, to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. It just again happens quite naturally because you're not doing very much. You don't need so much oxygen, therefore they're just naturally, just the breath gets less and less, more smooth. Next, we say that much is just fulfilling the first Satipatthana. Second, when you learn to experience joy as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience pleasure as you breathe in and out, when you learn to experience the mental formation, citta sankhara, of pitta sukha as you breathe in and out, when you learn to calm this mental formation of pitta sukha as you breathe in and out, on those occasions you are mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful, for being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. That is why on that occasion the meditator abides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, and fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. You experience the joy and the pleasure. Number one, this is what is supposed to happen. This is what the Buddha said. This is what it's supposed to do. So don't be afraid of the joy and pleasure which comes at this stage of the meditation. You know, sometimes people say, oh, you're enjoying yourself, you get attached. Pleasure is bad in religious life. And this is total just wrong. Too often that, you know, I've been meditating and people take your smile off your face, you're not practicing enough. You're going to experience suffering. You only get someone with suffering, no pain, no gain. And this is total wrong. You're supposed to enjoy the joy and the happiness. It's an important part of the path. And number two, where does that joy and happiness come from? It's not from the body. It's not a kaya sankhara. It's a chitta sankhara. It's a mental formation. And I've said this so many times, it just happens that when you start to get very calm and peaceful, your mindfulness really starts to increase. Everything you see, smell, hear, feel becomes so pleasurable. The old content of the toilet bowl during a retreat, similarly. You can never say, you know, the contents of a toilet bowl, you know, that the happiness, the joy actually exists in that sort of, you know, the product of a number two. How come it looked really beautiful? It was a mental formation of that, the chitta sankhara. It's natural. When you get very peaceful and still and highly mindful, whatever you see, the mind adds beauty to. The leaf on a tree, never seen anything so green before. There's clouds in the sky, incredible. And just the food which you eat becomes incredibly delicious. It's not inherent in the food. It's not a kaya sankhara. It's a chitta sankhara. What you add to it. And it's important you do this. It's natural. That's why this is full of so much little interesting bits here. And this is you learn how to experience these things and understand where they're coming from. And, okay, we might as well carry on. When you learn to experience the jitta as you breathe in and out, you learn to brighten the nimitta. It's the Sampasadanam Chittang. You know what his name is? Sampasada. And you learn to settle the nimitta, Samadhaṃ Chittaṃ, and then Vimocchaṃ Chittaṃ. Those are the four parts, the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stage of Anapanasati. And it's nice to hear the jitta. What is that jitta experience when you get this great joy is coming up in the mind? You get this beautiful light coming up. The nimitta. Why do I say that that jitta is the nimitta? You can see that the saying, I forget what it is now, that this mind is pabhasara, pabhasara chittang, which means luminous when the hindrances are not on top of it. This is what's happening here. That ninth stage at last is like the jitta, like the moon, full moon, free from the clouds. The defilements just have disappeared for a little while. The five hindrances are weakened. So it becomes like this beautiful nimitta, this light in the mind, the pabhasara jitta. And that's actually where the first time you can really get to understand what this jitta is. And at the same time, five senses are mostly gone. These are very weak. And then you learn to brighten it up. Give it a bit more energy. Boost the brightness. And those people who practice it to this stage, it's, you know, sometimes it's incredibly bright. I don't know how many. Over in Jhana Grove, I've got these, courtesy of Singapore Airlines, nice little plug for Singapore Airlines, got all these eye shades. I got those there because sometimes people say, oh, I can't be seeing a light, it must be some imagination, or the light coming through the windows or something. And I put these eye shades on them. And it's actually a real light. Another thing which happens when we start seeing them, but sometimes the eyelids begin to flicker. It's a response which they can't really control. Are they seeing a light? Are they not seeing a light? So they put the eye shades on there and they know they can't be seeing a light. It's not outside of them, it's inside them. It's beautiful light. So then eventually you learn how to brighten it up until it gets incredibly bright. Really, like 1,000 suns, more than that. You think, wow, I can't take any more brightness. And just happens naturally anyway, just let go and it'll happen. Just don't stop the process. Don't get involved. Just let it happen. And also to stabilize it, to still it. Samadhan. It's one of the reasons why, you know, that samadhi, concentration, you don't concentrate the nimitta, you stabilize it, keep it still, peaceful. That's where, you know, I started to think concentration is not the right word, stillness. So to keep that nimitta still, so it's not moving all over the place. Those two things work together. When it's still, it gets brighter. When it gets brighter, it's easy to keep still. And then eventually that leads into the jhanas. Vimocha, freeing the jitta. Freeing the jitta, freeing this mind totally from the five senses. So before, the five senses are weakened, but when you get into the jhanas, the five senses are not really there. Five hindrances also gone. Then you've got the jitta right in front of you. You're in it. So that's where you really understand it. You understand what it's like to be in a jhana. A mind liberated, free. In a jitta. In a jhana. So, on these occasions you are mindful of the jitta, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. Sometimes people say, oh, you're in a jhana, you're not mindful. Very mindful. But it says, inside the jhanas you are mindful. I do not say there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull, who is not fully aware. And that's reaching the jhana, because that's where the hindrances go. That is why on that occasion a mind meditator arrives mindful of the mind, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. And four, when you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation, explore things fading away in breath meditation, learn to explore things ceasing in breath meditation, when you learn to explore relinquishing things in breath meditation, that's the last four stages of anapanasati, impermanence, fading away, ceasing, relinquishing. On those equations you are mindful of mind objects, the Dhamma, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful, having seen with wisdom the impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment of the five hindrances. You've watched that. You've experienced it. That's what happens in the jhanas. The impermanence, fading away, cessation and relinquishment of the five hindrances. And you are mindful with equanimity. That is why on that occasion you are mindful of mind objects, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. That is how mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And I'll pause there because afterwards how they complete the seven factors of enlightenment, and after the seven factors of enlightenment how she fulfill the everything, enlightenment. But that's the last part. It's pretty much exactly what we said before, so maybe next time I'll just go straight to the jhanas. But any questions on that so far? I know, is this being broadcast overseas? Is there any questions from overseas? Okay.
Hello, Ajahn Brahm. I have a question on delusion.
Mm-hmm.
In the origination or origin of all suffering, yeah, it says that delusion leads to having will.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow it goes to the senses. But how do you get the delusions before the senses arise?
Again, this is a bit of what becomes first, the chicken or the egg idea. But it's a wonderful thing to see that from the delusion is this idea that you can get what you want, that by striving that you'll find some freedom, some security, some safety. And after a while, something comes up to give you a little bit of wisdom to actually to try letting go. And there you find, because letting go is not creating the sankhara, it's not doing the will anymore. Sankhara, one of its core meanings is will. Volitional formations. The volition is really important, much more so the formation. is a will. And so that a little bit of a time, you get sort of a letting go of the five hindrances, and that actually stops the will for a little while, enough to have an opportunity to see through delusion, see things as they truly are. Or the other little statement which comes up again and again and again from the Buddha is that it's from those, that stillness, from the jhanas, that you see things as they truly are. Samadhi pachiyam yata bhutiyana dasana. That deep, deep stillness is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. Because the point is, from that stillness, it overcomes the five hindrances for a while, which gives you that little window of opportunity, that window of clarity, to actually to see what was delusion, what is clarity. And from there, that you weaken the hindrances until the hindrances are totally overcome. Only then can you say that delusion has been abandoned. Okay, got some questions from overseas.
Thank you.
Okay. It's Venerable Canada. In London, that's Venerable Chanda. I have a question about being mindful, about not being mindful. Is it possible the Buddha is talking about two different levels of mindfulness, either basic mindfulness developed before jhana and satipatthana, knows that a deeper, more penetrative mindfulness after jhana is absent? It is actually true that there are different levels of mindfulness, but I think here, like, it means that you understand what mindfulness is and what mindfulness isn't, and it doesn't really mention the different powers of the mindfulness here, but it is a case that in that forced satipatthana of understanding these mind states, you know, how can you really be mindful, really understand, you know, when there's no mindfulness there, or when the mindfulness is weak? Even if it's not, you know, if it's weak, you can sort of understand it, but you're not getting the full picture. You're subject to being deluded, and you can't trust, you know, what you see. So, in order to truly understand it, you're mindful that mindfulness wasn't there afterwards. So otherwise, it's not real full mindfulness. You can still sort of get it wrong time and time again. Okay, so it is actually now 4:30. And it's time that monks went back to their monastery before a big storm comes. So now we actually do some bowing down. And actually, what time is it now? 8:00. You should still be resting, Venerable Chanda, in London. Go back to bed. Take a rest. So, okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We're going to do some bowing now. An arahang sama.